Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and students scattered across space and time, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is, once again, your nav speaking on the 13th of July, 2012, Friday the 13th. And your nav, of course, is John Lash. I want to say again, as I've said many times, that the nav briefings and a great deal of other material in the Gaia Navigation Experiment is presented, received, and processed within strict time parameters in sync to real-time events. So, for instance, today I'm recording on the day of an apogee surge. There is an apogee surge of the moon at 20 degrees of Taurus today, Friday the 13th. 20 degrees of Taurus, or 50 degrees of ecliptic longitude, is still before the pentagramic constellation of stars representing the satanic mask of Cetus, but it's moved away from a lock-in position to the gaze of Cetus, and a lock-in position to the back brain of the Cetus slash Archon slash Aromatic monster. So we know that this indicates that we are moving out of a stall and things are breaking loose all over the place. Even though I'm recording this talk in real time right now, and even though the parameters of this talk are uniquely relevant to the moment in which it's made, this talk is an enduring chronicle of our experiment with Gaia navigation. And so those who come later, or yourselves at a later time, a month, a year, 5 years from now, can listen to this talk as a chronicle of a great adventure undertaken by a few brave and inspired people on the planet Earth at a moment when the Earth was facing one of the most terrible crises in its long history as a laboratory for the human experiment. The title of this talk today is Dakini Pinball. I'd like to cover a couple of things. I'm not going to be talking about recent subjects, which I'll pick up again soon, recent themes, but rather to concentrate on the theme of Dakini instruction in the Shakti cluster. I'd like to see if I can make it more user-friendly, and I'd also like to point out some of the benefits and kicks of the practice of Dakini transception in planetary tantra. Before I launch into a Nahualesque description of Dakini pinball, I'd like to indicate some current observations regarding the astronomy of the GNE, the real-time astronomy, and also to put out a request to the crew for a little favor. You know, I said in a recent talk that we are witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess. In astronomical terms, that means witnesses to the unique, original, and novel immediacy of the cosmos at every single moment. It's only in the archonic paradigm, in the mental funk of the archontic paradigm, that we are falsely induced into thinking that everything is regular, everything is predictable in the cosmos. And the reality is that the cosmic order is infinitely variable. It's full of change and novelty. There's no better moment to appreciate this fact than during the 3 years of correction. During these 3 years, when the initial conditions of correction are set, we and the crew are observing a remarkable sequence of fluid, alternating, and nonlinear events in the sky. Most particularly, the motion of the lunar apogee in a tango dance with Jupiter, of which I've spoken numerous times. You know, you could go back and try to calculate. You could take the cycle of Jupiter around the Earth or around the Sun. You could compute it geocentrically or heliocentrically. And then you could compare that cyclic period of Jupiter, which is about a little under 12 years, to the 8.5-year cycle of the rotation of the lunar apsides. And then you could sit down with a pencil and a calculator and just work out how the two cycles would be coordinated. You could work out that, the combination, the coincidence of those two cycles and how they lapse into synchronicity and lapse out again. You know, an 11.8-year cycle roughly, contrasted to something like an 8.5-year cycle. And then you could come up with, an archontically framed prediction of the next time that the apogee of the Moon and Jupiter would encounter each other. And that calculation would be relatively worthless. What's really interesting is to observe it in real time as it happens. And as you're doing so, to let the fact register on your mind that this is only happening once in this very unique way right now. You know, there may be other moments in time when the apogee of the Moon and Jupiter would do a tango dance with each other. But at what other moment in time would they do it between the Pleiades and the star Aldebaran in the Eye of the Bull? At what other time would they do it in conjunction with a remarkable retrograde cycle of Venus tracing both horns of the bull as it makes a double rendezvous with Jupiter? You're going to go look through the entire range of scientific astronomical data projected by archontic calculating devices, and you will not ever, ever find another time when this happened in the past or will happen in the future. So we're in a wonderful perspective. We on the crew are in a wonderful moment of learning to observe the cosmos. Not only are these developments of the lunar apsides and the other planetary movements during correction of a unique and spectacular nature and largely accessible to observation, but they are as well loaded and supercharged with the significance we find when we engage and read the cosmic code. And the language of correction, the procedures of correction, are written in this code, which in itself is a kind of device for translating from the Nahual into the realm of ordinary human understanding. I myself marvel frequently, and I myself stand in wonderment of this process, this navigational experiment in which we are engaged. And I would say that if that same sense of wonderment crashes over you from time to time, then you are really in this experiment. You really know what it's about, and the excitement of it can only increase and accelerate as correction proceeds. So on that note, I'd like to point out to you a most particular, exquisitely specific detail of planetary activity during the 6 months of correction, from June 2012 to December 2012. Bear in mind that we're looking closely at the way the apogee of the moon proceeds through the constellations, the fishes, the ram, the bull, into the twins, and finally into the crab, where it stands in the spring of 2014. At the same time, we're watching and we're observing the stalls that it makes as it transits through these constellations. At the same time, we're observing the close proximity of Jupiter and the retrograde cycles of Jupiter. We see how Jupiter sometimes advances ahead of the lunar apogee. Then it stops, turns retrograde, goes back, converges with it again. And these converges of Jupiter and the lunar apogee are tremendously charged moments. They indicate tremendously charged moments in the recapitulations of the wisdom goddess. And out of those recapitulations, she formulates specific tactics of her correction. And we are the witnesses to this event in real time. Now, as if you didn't already have an abundance of richness on board, let me give you something else. There are events in the sky that I have observed over the past 35 or 40 years called occultations. An occultation is the scientific term, the astronomical term, in fact, for a very specific event that is observable, usually observable, in the night sky. Somewhere in my files and archives, which are currently stored in Portugal, I have a record of my observation of occultations that took place over a number of years in the 70s and into the early 80s. At that time, I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at 7,000 feet in the Rocky Mountains, the so-called Sangre de Cristos Mountains. And from a plateau behind my house, I had an ideal viewing of the night sky, and I observed a number of occultations by the moon. Lunar occultations are specifically those events that occur when the visible body of the moon passes in front of a star or planet. I remember once, I have somewhere in my records a table that I kept. I don't know what the year was. It's hard to say. Maybe 78, 79. I kept a meticulous table because I noted in that year, get this folks, there were 13 occultations of Aldebaran. Now, that's the absolute most you can have, because there are only 13 passes of the moon over one area of the zodiac in a year. There are 13 lunations in a year. The star Aldebaran in the eye of the bull, which is right now a key factor in the correction configuration, if you might call it that, in the correction display of relay, let's call it that. Deborah is right there. The eye of the bull is watching the correction process occur. It's the eye of the bull is watching the spindling through the Pleiades and the unrolling of the 21 filaments of pleromic relay. It's all being observed by the eye of the bull, you could say. Well, there was a year sometime back when there were actually 13 occasions in which the sphere of the moon, the orb of the moon, actually passed in front of the star Aldebaran in the eye of the bull. And I was able to observe some, but not all, of those lunar occultations from the Llano above my house in Santa Fe. Just imagine that, 13 occultations of Aldebaran. I wrote a poem about it, actually, in the Yeats conversions. Now, lunar occultations can be observed if the moon is up in the sky at the evening where you're located. They are very easy to observe if you know the moment to look for them. They usually take about 3 hours. Beginning in June 2012, in fact, beginning the day after June 16th, when Pleromic Relay is initially engaged, there occurs a series of lunar occultations. One of these has already passed. The second one is coming up in 2 days. And following that, there are 5 others. So, in the last 6 months of 2012, there are six lunar occultations, one every month. And some of these will be visible to some of you at various places on the planet, depending, of course, on atmospheric conditions. Now, I bet you're wondering just what exactly, what body, what celestial body the moon would be occultating. Well, there's two kinds of lunar occultations. The moon can pass, the body of orb of the moon can pass in front of a fixed star. So that is what occurred when I observed the occultations of Aldebaran in the Eye of the Bull, because that is a fixed star. But the moon can also pass in front of a planet. There have been such events, for instance, as lunar occultations of Venus. In fact, there was a magnificent lunar occultation of Venus in December of 2008. On my birthday, in fact. And that was an amazing lunar occultation that I observed here in Gaucin, in the mountains of Andalusia. I observed it from my house, and also I was so out of my mind with mania at that time. Actually, was so delirious with the beauty and splendor of this occultation that I jumped in the car and drove up to the gasolinera to buy a bottle of champagne, because here in town you buy champagne at the gasoline station, good champagne, you know, Veuve Clicquot. And I observed this occultation from the gas station. This occultation of December 2008 happened in such a manner that the moon was in a crescent phase. The occultations can happen at all phases of the moon. For instance, the moon might be in a full moon, a fully illumined orb, and then it would pass in front of Venus or Mars or some other planet. But it was just a crescent moon. And yet the entire orb of the moon, not just the crescent, but even the dark part, obviously passed in front of Venus. And when Venus emerged, it looked like a diamond earring hanging on the crescent moon, as if it were hanging on a woman's ear. Occultations can be breathtakingly beautiful sights. And they are, I would add, key moments for deep and penetrating meditations. So I'm going to propose to you, now that I'm getting to the crunch here, how we might use these six remaining occultations. I propose that we use them to synchronize ourselves on channel 16. And that would certainly be most appropriate for these particular occultations. Why? Well, I think you probably guessed. What planet or star is being occultated by the moon each month now until the 26th of December 2012? Well, it wouldn't happen to be anything other but Jupiter, would it? Now let's just stop here for a minute and consider what we're getting into. Look at what the Narwhal has claimed about Pleromic Relay. look at what we have established by the use of the second attention to follow Sophia's story, to track her recapitulation. Look at what we've mastered by way of first-hand observation of the sky. Look at all that. Put that all together and tie it up in a big package and tie this big golden ribbon around it. And on the golden ribbon is written, you are living at the unique moment of the correction of the wisdom goddess, and these cosmic signals attune you and involve you directly in that event. That's what's written on the big golden ribbon around this gift treasure package. And given that all that is true, how fantastic is it that we have 7 consecutive occultations of Jupiter beginning at exactly the moment that pleromic relay engages? What do you think about that, Mimedes? On the 15th of July, there's an occultation of Jupiter by the moon. The 11th of August, the 8th of September, the 5th of October, the 2nd of November, and the 26th of December, 2012. Wow. And wow again. You can't make this up, as Alex Jones says. You can't make this stuff up. He's usually talking about the horrors of the predators. I'm talking about the wonders of the wisdom goddess. You can't make this stuff up. But you can sure be part of it. Just imagine what we can do with these moments. Just imagine, who could have ever devised such a scheme for the participants in correction to synchronize themselves to it? Who could have ever devised such a scheme? You know, the occultations of the planet Jupiter by the moon do not happen regularly and annually. They happen in a non-linear, erratic, and novel manner, as I've explained, that everything in the universe happens this way. And so, how come we get a sequence of them kicked off at the very moment when pleromic relay kicks off? How come we get that? I mean, this is astonishing to me. And I'm right here in the middle of this process, following every detail and development with my nose to the charts. I am used to wild and astonishing insights, and this is really over the top. So what I would like to ask is if some member of the crew would do us all a favor and calculate the hour of universal time when these upcoming occultations occur. I don't have to explain how to do that. Those few members of the crew who might be inclined to would already know, but I will explain just for the sake of letting you all know. Just go to the day when the moon transits the degree of Jupiter. For instance, you would go to August 11th, and you would note the exact degree and minute of Jupiter on that day. So the degree and minute of Jupiter on August 11th is 11 degrees and 54 minutes of Gemini. Then if you slide your finger over to the column showing the longitude of the moon, you'll find that the longitude of the moon at midnight on the 11th of August is 1 degree and 53 minutes of Gemini, and that on midnight of the succeeding day, it's 13 degrees and 44 minutes. So you simply extrapolate between those two positions to know at what hour of the day, universal time, the moon would arrive at 11 degrees and 54 minutes of Gemini, which would be very close to around 10 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, August the 11th, universal time. So would some intrepid crew member please make those calculations for the upcoming occultations right down to December 26th and send them on to the NAV so that I can post them in the next crew notes. Now, having ragged on your first attention sufficiently with all this astronomical data, I want to conclude by making an observation that is going to have enduring consequences in our experience of correction. This observation concerns the difference between simultaneous time and serial time. Now, remember I've been talking about channel 16. We're all really tuned to channel 16 now. A couple of you have written in. You're already starting to use channel 16. So recall that channel 16 is the intercom of the Shakti cluster. It is the planetary telepathy router provided by the wisdom goddess herself. Using this router, we can both send and receive to each other. We can do telepathic networking in planetary tantra. And we can do it in ways that are veracious, testable, and repeatable. And we can do it in a sober collaboration of minds and hearts that will prove to have consistent results, because we are using the real and not the fantastic imagination. Now, when anyone engages in experiments with telepathy, and I have done a few, I haven't done that many, I'm eager to really delve into it now with channel 16 open and running. But when anyone looks into experiments with telepathy, a particular issue always arises, at least for me it always does. And that is the issue of, are we going to do telepathy? Say that I agree with Stephanie in Santa Fe that we're going to do telepathy together. She's a crew member interested in Starbase, and she's read Quest for the Zodiac. So we agree by communicating by email or talking on Skype using these archonic devices that we're going to forego all archonic communication, go into channel 16, and do telepathy together. Okay, let's do it. There's always this question. Are we going to do it in simultaneous time or in serial time? By that I mean, how can the telepathic experiment be set up in regard to the time frame of the individuals involved? Now, the time difference between where I am and Santa Fe is, I believe, 9 hours. So suppose I proposed to Stephanie, okay, at 9 o'clock p.m., my time in Spain, I'm going to spend 10 minutes in telepathic communication with you. So tune in to me at noon your time. That's simultaneous time. Now, we can conduct telepathic experiments in simultaneous time. But we can also conduct them in serial time. In serial time, it doesn't matter if the two people engaged in an experiment are actually performing the experiment simultaneously in different time zones across the Earth. Simultaneous synchronization can be used for certain experiments with telepathy, but it doesn't always have to. Now, this is my intuition. I would guess that channel 16 in the Shakti cluster is designed to operate in serial transmissions of telepathy. Because that's the easiest way, and Gaia is offering her psychotronic technology in a user-friendly manner. Gaian psychotronics is user-friendly, intuitive, and everything that our contact technology is not. It's also sensory and sensorial and sensuous, which our contact technology is not. So, using channel 16 as crew members communicating with each other across time and space, across the time zones of the planet, is easy. Do it any time we like. I can transmit a telepathic message through the router of channel 16 at any time I like, and you out there can pick it up at any time you like. So the general operation of channel 16 is a free access, is free access transmission in serial time. Clear? However, we're just learning what is channel 16 and how to use it. And so in order to get onto channel 16 in the beginning, in order to lock ourselves in to the frequency of channel 16, begin to feel comfortable with that. Begin to know exactly what is the difference between the silence of the radio turned off and the silence of the intercom channel when the radio is turned on. The difference between the white noise in your mind, which is filled with insane and extraneous chatter, and the invitational silence of channel 16. This is to be learned. Those in the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment have the immense privilege of being in the avant-garde of learning how to use this Gaian psychotronic technology. So here we go. The indications you're getting from the nav right now, you might as well be getting from VV in regard to how she would instruct her accomplices in the use of the technology she provides to them. And I put it to you that these six upcoming occultations of Jupiter by the moon are provided by the wisdom goddess to be inceptive moments of practice with channel 16. And for the inception of the channel and the inception of your telepathic and telesentient faculties coordinated to the channel, we use simultaneous telepathy. And the moment of the simultaneous transmissions is given by the cosmos itself. It's given by that 1, 2, 3 hour interval, which is the same for all of us all around the planet, when the orb of the moon passes before the planet Jupiter and temporarily excludes it from sight. How wonderful is that? Wherever you may be, in Australia, in the Ukraine, in the United Kingdom, New Mexico, California, wherever you may be in Europe, when the next occultation of Jupiter occurs on the 15th of July and the succeeding on the 11th of August and the 8th of September, it occurs at the same moment for everyone on the planet. But it is only visible to certain of us depending on our locale at that moment and depending on the fact, of course, that the transiting moon must be observable in the sky at that moment. In that case, you can actually go out and watch the occultation. But regardless of whether you're a crew member who is watching it or not, I invite all crew members to join in simultaneous telepathic connection at the moment of these occultations. Now, how do I propose to set up this? Well, I don't know. I've never done this before. Nobody's ever done this before. We have short notice for the first occultation. Let me calculate right now what hour of the day that would occur. Turns out to be a fairly simple exercise. It occurs around 3 a.m. Universal time, 3 a.m. in the morning on this day, Sunday, July 15th. Reason being that at midnight on that day, the moon is in 5 degrees 42 minutes of Gemini, and it only has to advance to 7 degrees and 9 minutes. So it has to advance less than 2 degrees in order to be exact conjunction with Jupiter. So it would be exactly over Jupiter at 3 a.m. and 8 minutes in the morning. So it would take then, let's just say, an hour and a half on either side. So take an hour and a half going in and an hour and a half coming out as it goes across the planet Jupiter. So each of you, depending on your locale, would calculate what local time this occurs. And of course, then you would correspondingly know if you could observe Jupiter or not. I can certainly observe it here at that hour of the morning, which is 5 a.m. in the morning, my time. So the occultation would occur just before sunrise, when the crescent moon slides into the configuration of Aldebaran, Venus, and Jupiter. So there you go. And again, in August, September, October, November, December. Now, how do I propose to set up this telepathic coordination for that moment? I propose that you concentrate subvocally on this phrase. Watching the correction of the wisdom goddess through the eye of the bull, let the heroes emerge. Dot, dot, dot. This is just a spontaneous phrase. I don't know exactly how to set up these experiments in regard to what kind of syntactic, mantric, or subvocal formula might apply. We only have 2 days' notice for the upcoming one. We'll see how things develop in the future months. I can't bring myself to suggest that we transmit an intention simultaneously at this moment. That is why I propose using a phrase that is open, a phrase that implies an intention. Two intentions, actually. The intentions of this telepathic experiment are to bring our vision together in the eye of the bull, just as we bring the telepathic signaling together through channel 16. In doing so, create an anticipation for the heroes to emerge. Obviously, it's imperative in the course of correction that heroes who stand for the goddess and fight to protect her, heroes of both gender, would emerge, identify themselves, and join forces. So I'm just suggesting off the top of my head that we take the first moment of simultaneous telepathy, dawn hours of Sunday, July 15th, to do so. And then we'll see together how we might develop more sophisticated and precise coordination for the remaining 5 occultations. Now, having covered all that, I can finally come around to the topic that I originally intended for this talk regarding interaction with the Dakinis. That is to say, the elementary practice of using the Shakti cluster, working with the Shakti cluster. Following the lunar shifts each month is a fascinating exercise, needless to say. Now that I have laid out the complete nomenclature of the 18 channels, some of you who haven't been too inclined to this practice might feel a little more comfortable with it. That's just the intention of this talk and others as well. And I would like to explain to you why we need this complex network of Dakini frequencies in order to navigate with the planetary animal mother. It's rather as if your mind was a pinball machine. Consider that for a moment, that your mind works like a pinball machine. Now, a pinball machine has a platform, as you know, a horizontal platform. It's usually tilted, sloping slightly upward. And then it has a vertical part, which has the score on it, shows the score and shows various other readings of the game as you proceed. Down at the right-hand corner of the horizontal part of the pinball machine is the pin. It's a sprocketed pin. You pull it back, you retract the spring, a silver ball drops into the funnel, you let go of the pin, and it ejects the ball into the machine. And then what happens? Well, the structure of a pinball machine, of a field, the field of play, as it were, consists of two parts. One is the holes, the places where the pinball that the places the pinball goes into, the pockets, as it were, equivalent to the pockets on a pool table. And pockets have different values. So some pockets, you get the pinball into one pocket and you get 20 points, and another pocket you might get 200 points. Additional to the pockets, there are the bumpers. The bumpers are these columns that stand up, and they have a rubber rim around them. And they are really critical to the game, because by slightly shifting the pinball machine back and forth with your hands, but not shifting it so far that you tilt it, you can influence the ball as it ricochets among the different areas of the field of play. As you jostle the table, the console of the pinball machine, back and forth slightly, with the palm of your hand, sometimes maybe even jouncing it with your hip, as a sexy and skilled pinball player will do, you actually maintain the momentum of the pinball as it's ricocheting between the various posts or rubberized turrets, as it were, that are in the field of play, and this is how you play pinball. And each time you hit a turret, the machine rings, you ring up a score, and you watch the vertical panel of the pinball machine to see the scores you're making. So you get, I don't know what, 5 balls to a game. They come out of the spring-loaded sprocket with a tremendous speed. Then they bounce around in the console. Some of them go down into different pockets. That's the end of the game for that particular pinball. And others ricochet wildly among the turrets, each hit causing an amplification of velocity of the pinball and ringing up a score. So there it is. There's a simple, straightforward description of how pinball works. But it could as well be a description of how your mind works, insofar as your mind is a field of play for Dakini instruction. You know, there's a principle in the term of Gaia Awakening that says, samsara and this enlightenment have the same look. Now, another way to put that is to say that your ordinary mind is the Buddha mind, and vice versa. That was the way it was said in the past. I think, however, that to repeat that Chan and Zen teaching today, it would be wise to add a particular nuance. Your ordinary mind and the Buddha mind are the same when your ordinary mind is realized in its subliminal operations. But if your ordinary mind is only realized in its ordinary operations, then you're not really in the enlightenment of your mind. The thinking of the Dakinis, if you want to call it thinking, is constantly operating in your mind. Right now, as you're listening to my words, the pristine cognition of the Dakinis, as the Tibetans call it, is a spontaneous upsurge of the enlightened mind into the ordinary mind. I prefer to call this operation of Dakini thinking subliminal, because it is at a level just below the threshold of your ordinary awareness. If you need some kind of analogy or concrete metaphor to grasp how the Dakini thinking enters your mind, your ordinary mind, then just think of the pinball launching device. When you stand there to begin a game of pinball, you put in some money and four or five balls are loaded into the chamber of the pinball console. When you pull back the plunger, one of those balls drops into position at the head of the plunger, and when you let the plunger go, bingo, at very high velocity, that pinball is ejected into the gameplay field of the console. Just so, at every instant, every single instant of your conscious awareness, and likewise at every instant when you are unconscious and asleep, crystal clear and lightning fast, parcels of Dakini cognition are being released into your mind. Quanta of Dakini cognition, if you want to put it that way. Signal bursts of enlightened Dakini cognition are continually popping into your mind like pinballs. And their velocity is a subliminal velocity. You don't notice them because they operate at a speed that exceeds the speed in which you can normally think. And there is a velocity of thinking, which is variable. This is a feature of the first attention. It operates at certain fixed velocities. But if you're in a stressful situation, for instance, in a car accident or in a house fire, when you need to think more rapidly than usual, you may find yourself in the unfortunate situation where your first attention will collapse and you won't be able to think. That would be due to fear acting upon the first attention with a constricting effect. But if you're fortunate, as many people are, the predisposed fail-safe mechanism of the first attention would allow you to think faster and more efficiently than you could normally think. So we know from ordinary experiences that the velocity of the thought process can change. Generally speaking, however, the velocity of Dakini instruction operating within your mind, giving you access to the enlightened mind of Buddhahood all the time, is operating at a velocity that escapes you. This is the escape velocity of the pinball entering the console. Why do you need to learn each month? I don't say why do you need, that's bad language. Why would you want to learn? Why would you bother and take the time and effort to follow the Dakini shifts each month and to learn to detect the frequencies of these 16 different channels? Why would you do that? Simply because if you had a pinball machine that has a plunger device but no pockets and no turrets, it's not going to be a very interesting game. The pinball would be launched into the field of the machine, but it has no pockets to go to score, and it has no turrets or towers to bounce off to make it more interesting and to keep the velocity high. So what will happen is that the pinball will be launched into the console of the pinball machine, and it will just ricochet off one of the walls and lose its momentum very quickly and stop. And it will, if the console is tilted, as most pinball machines are, the ball will just roll to the bottom of the console and sit there inertly, and that is the way most people's minds work. That is the way the human mind works generically and universally until you plug it into the Shakti cluster. Then when you plug it into the Shakti cluster, you equip your neural linguistic circuits with a set of turrets and a set of pockets. And you are in the game of Dakini instruction. You need Dakini instruction just the way a pinball machine needs the turrets for the ball to ricochet off. You ricochet, your mind in its subliminal frequencies ricochets off Kurukula. It ricochets off Tara, the raffle green Tara, or it ricochets off Vajrayogini, or even Vivi. The ricochet factor is what keeps the Dakini frequency operating actively in your mind so that you have time to grasp it. If the Dakini frequencies don't have an internal neuro-linguistic structure to ricochet off, you will never capture them because they come and go too rapidly. Now, the velocity that the pinball reaches when it's being knocked and directed by the skillful player from one turret to another never equals the launch velocity that it has when it comes out of the plunger, obviously. So, it could, though, it could, if you were really a very skillful player, you could bounce the pinball between the turrets in such a manner that it would achieve the release velocity of when it came out of the plunger. And that's when you have Dakini instruction as if it were the normal operation of your own mind. And then you don't have any other mind. Then you don't have a normal mind anymore. To be a Nahual operative with the Shakti cluster means that you don't have an ordinary mind anymore. You have the mind of the Dakinis. But in order to have it, you need to play pinball with the subliminal frequencies that they are continually bursting into your mind. So it's a pleasure to engage with these Dakini frequencies. It's a pleasure to listen for them, to recognize the instruction when it comes according to the Dakini it comes from, who never identifies herself, by the way. You have to acclimatize yourself to the impact. You know from the impact which Dakini it is. You know from the oral or audio signature. You know from the theme and tone. And you yourself must identify which one it is. This is part of the skill of Dakini pinball. So you can see that although it may be complicated, it may appear to be complicated and forbidding in certain ways, the structure of the Shakti cluster is a fantastic interactive gift, a gift from the wisdom goddess herself. She constructed the Shakti cluster. It's not the Turton who discovered it, did not construct it. It is her construction. It is an instrument of her mind implanted in the atmosphere of the earth in such a way that it simultaneously exists in the psychic and mental field of the human animal. She can do that, and she did. I don't know how long it took her to construct it or how she went about the process. All I know is that in the summer of 2008, the Shakti cluster was ready for interactivity with human animals. And now, some 4 years later, I'm proud and happy to tell you that it works like a pinball machine, and that you need the complexity, the apparent complexity of the 16 Dakini channels to handle the subliminal frequencies of enlightenment bursting in your own mind. I can also tell you with pride and confidence what exactly the planetary animal mother wants in her interactivity with the human animal. She wants the high precision and lavishness that she herself experiences as a planetary animal. Remember that the signature of a divine being, a god or aeon, is generosity rather than love, although love is certainly not lacking in the aeons. So this invention, this fantastic contraption of the Shakti cluster is the gift of the wisdom goddess to humanity with the intention that those who attune to her can experience the precision and richness of her consciousness just as she herself experiences it. How wonderful is that? Now, of course, no single human being could come anywhere close to encompassing the full scope of her awareness. But the potential of the Shakti cluster is nevertheless infinite for everyone who engages it. Infinite richness, infinite precision, infinite lavish comprehension of nature, of the human psyche, of biology, of the atmosphere, of the elementary chemistry of Earth, of the activities of the non-human kingdoms of plants, insects, reptiles, animals. All of this is what the planetary animal mother wants you to have and to know and love and enjoy. And what else is there to do on this planet if you're not caught in the trap of social conformity and in the insanity of the archons? What else would you rather do with your time than play pinball with the Dakinis? You will find as you do so that although the Shakti cluster is the same for all of us, the way each one of us plays it is different. It's as if we were each playing on pinball machines whose construction of pockets and turrets matches our NLP. Now, I have to play on a pinball machine that has a centrally located turret. That transmits channel one. So I do a lot of ricocheting off that turret. My mind, my psyche, my sensibility is geared to Mahakali, ferociously geared. And so when I tend to play the pinball machine of the Shakti cluster, I'm engaging all 16 points of it, 16 points of structure, just like you are. But I tend to bounce the pinball more frequently off some turrets than others. I mean, this is how it works. And it's the same with you. And you become conversant with your own enlightenment when you know which turrets of the pinball field your mind uses more frequently than others. And of course, that's how you identify your guardian. Your guardian in the Shakti cluster, and everyone in planetary tantra has a specific guardian in the Shakti cluster, can be compared to the tower or turret you use to keep up the velocity of the pinball to its highest level. But you can bounce the pinball off any turret you like. So I hope this analogy is helpful. I think it's pretty amusing. I really like it myself. And I'm delighted that I came up with it, actually. And I guess I should add in conclusion that to be consistent in the metaphor, or the analogy, rather, to be consistent with this analogy, I would have to assign some significance to the pockets. Well, what are the pockets? Well, those are the deposits, the place where Dakini transmission becomes permanently deposited in your psyche. You see? Now, if you have Matangi as your guide, as many of you do, many of you coming into planetary tantra have the great fortune of having Matangi as your guardian, then you will deposit or register instructions from Matangi each time that the pinball frequencies of your mind hit the turret that corresponds to Matangi. So say that you're playing a round of pinball, you're in Dakini instruction, you're bouncing the ball off the Dakini, off the Matangi turret over and over again. Bingo, the machine is ringing. Bingo, you're scoring insights. And then finally it bounces off the Matangi tower into a pocket. There you do register and retain for recall in ordinary consciousness the insights that you acquired by that session of pinball. Dakini instruction occurs in an altered state of subliminal thinking, which the Tibetans call pristine cognition. That is thinking that cannot be elaborated. It arrives in a pristine and fully elaborated condition. It is difficult to retain this Dakini instruction in your ordinary state of mind. However, you can integrate it if you hold it in the mental process over and over again. This is equivalent to gently moving the pinball machine between the palms of your hands, gently urging it now and then with your hip so that the pinball bounces again and again off your preferred turrets. And finally, when it goes into a pocket, you retain the instruction that you received. So there it is. There's my analogy of Dakini pinball. And of course, the last comment I would make is a skillful player doesn't tilt the machine. You don't force any of this. You don't hit the console too hard with the palm of your hand or your hip, because then the game stops and the big sign comes on the upper panel in red lettering, TILT. Don't tilt your mind when you're playing Dakini pinball. Don't force cognitive and intellectual conceptions into the process. Let it reveal itself. Don't go rational. Don't try to control it. Let it reveal itself in the spontaneous and emergent play of the enlightened content of your own mind, which is actually the only mind you really have, even though it isn't yours. And on that comment, I'll leave you to the game, looking forward to the next opportunity to speak to you in a Navigator briefing. Safe passage to all.